Good Wednesday afternoon, good Canada Day Eve, and hi, I'm Rob Snow. So great to be with you, and so great to have Dr. Barry Dworkin here for the Wednesday House Call. How are you?
I'm fine. No earthquake today, so
no,
that's okay.
No, you weren't here last week because it was a week ago today that the earth shook, and we were talking about and taking phone calls from our listeners about the earthquake, and that meant we unfortunately had to preempt the Wednesday House Call. You were back on Sunday, of course, speaking with your loyal listeners, and we're ready to take your health-related questions right now. As a matter of fact, every single phone line is available, and I encourage you to call early, 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 is a free phone call if you're on Bell Mobility, and a free long-distance call as well at 1-800-580-CFRA, 1-800-580-2372. Would love to hear from you in this hour of the program. Coming up a little bit later on, as you know, Mayor Larry O'Brien, CFRA News, broke the news last night around 9 o'clock that he would be seeking re-election. He confirmed that this morning, and we'll have reaction from his main political opponents today, Councillor Alex Cullen. Larry Barry's a big fan of Councillor Cullen.
Let's leave politics out of the medical show.
I'm just teasing you. So he'll be calling in a little bit later, and Jim Watson as well will be on the program today as well. But right to the phone lines we go for you, Dr. Dworkin. Mm-hmm. Will has a question about which Dr. Dworkin knows very, very well, knee surgeries.
Dr. Dworkin, just calling to find out, what is the lifespan of a knee replacement?
Depending on the type of knee replacement done and the materials used, some of the newer generation knee replacements can last quite some time. It's not the joint itself that goes in a knee replacement. It's when the shaft of the, let's put it this way, there are caps that are put on the ends of the bone that act as the joint. But those caps have a metal piece that is perforated that is jammed into the shaft of the bone, and then bone grows through it. It's almost like a Swiss cheese piece of metal, and the bone grows through it to strengthen and hold it in place, and they use glue as well.
Okay.
And so what happens over time with use is that small shaft or piece of the joint can loosen in the bone as someone gets older and depending on how much they've used the leg. However, there are newer techniques that are used that tend to extend the lifespan, and there are some, for example, with regards to partial knee replacements where they've lasted 25 years or longer. So it depends on the type of replacement that's done and the activity someone is participating in. But as with anything, it's always a quality of life thing. So you have to think of this as lasting maybe 15, 20 years, and usually they can revise it at least one more time. So you do have pretty much the rest of your life with a knee that will function, even if it has to be replaced in about 15 or 20 years.
Why do you ask, Will?
Because I went in to see my orthopod, and I was recommended for a knee replacement, and I went to see my orthopod, and he basically said, you're way too young, and your activity level is way too high to even try to think about this. He says, come see me when you are basically hobbling.
Well, I would...
And until such time, he says, don't even think about it, because you're okay the way you're going right now.
Well, let me ask you, how is your quality of life?
It's very good. I'm on a supplement regime. I'm taking glucosamine, methylsulfur. I forget that. MSM.
Yeah.
And chondroitin. I take bromelain as a Kirkherma. And I've been able to actually start running again because I'm a referee for rugby.
Okay. Well, if
I have to cover a lot more field than the players do.
Well,
the only thing I do, Dr. Dworkin, is before the game, just so I don't get any pain. Once a week, I take four ibuprofen before the game, an hour before the game, once a week.
Okay, well, and that's the key thing. It's a quality of life. So if your quality of life is such that you can do the things you want to do, the surgeon is absolutely right. There's no need to do the surgery.
Perfect.
If on the other hand, you are having difficulty doing the things that you want to do and you're in pain and you can't enjoy your life to the way you want to do it, that's when you look at the knee replacement. But your surgeon is right. Right now, there's no point, because you are doing the things that you were doing that you want to do right at this moment.
Tony.
Hello.
Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Yes, question is, last Monday I was at work, and I suddenly had a feeling that somebody put a hat full of pins and needles on my head, and then the electricity going through it, and then sudden dizziness.
pins and needles on your head.
Yeah, someone said I put a hat full of pins and needles.
Okay.
Okay. And then it suddenly felt like electricity was going through it.
Well, that,
and then the dizziness for about 5 minutes.
Right.
And then the headache after.
Well, I mean, this...
Did you go to the doctor?
Yes, I did. I did on the Thursday.
What did the doctor say?
Well, he did some tests. They didn't come back yet, so...
Yeah, I mean, usually when you have pins and needles, that the fancy term for that is called paresthesias, and that simply means that the nerve itself has been compromised, usually compressed. You know, it's same thing, you know.
Just out of the blue like that?
Well, you have to think of, is there something that his head was pushing on or something that hit him? I mean, I don't know the history.
Okay, well, let's ask.
So,
did anything happen, Tony?
Yeah.
What happened?
I was standing up serving a customer at Tim Hortons where I work, and all of a sudden it came on like that.
Oh, so it was a sudden onset.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the different things can do this type of thing. You can get, for example, a drop in blood pressure, which can do that. You can get, you know, you feel faint, or you can get a headache afterwards. Low blood sugar can do that as well if you're not eating. Hmm. It's very difficult for me on
very
it's
vague,
very
yes.
very limited yeah. Yeah. limited information. But if you're having the testing done, if you're having blood work done to see right. what's happening,
what would they be looking for?
Well,
what would they look
check
for?
Check for blood sugar, diabetes, low vitamin B12 levels, low iron, hemoglobin, thyroid function. Those type of things, at least from blood work, to see if they're contributing to that event. The fact that it lasted only 5 minutes meant that something very quick happened,
right.
And he recovered.
And it passed.
And it
has
passed.
This happened again, Tony? At all?
No, not since then.
You feel okay now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good news. Well, call back when you get those test results, and maybe we can help you a little bit more.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Tony.
Bye.
More thanks. Of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin ahead in Wednesday House Call. Dr. Dworkin is on holiday shortly, so we'll miss you next week. And we're hoping to get Dr. Friedhoff in from Bariatric Medical Institute, our weight control expert here on CFRA.
He always has some good stuff to say.
He sure does. What's his blog again?
Weighty Matters.
Weighty Matters,
yeah,
yes.
Fantastic
yes.
blog.
It's excellent. It's yeah. excellent. Still time, plenty of time, and plenty of phone lines to take your phone call. 521-TALK, *580, or 1-800-580-CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call, 521-TALK, *580, or 1-800-580-CFRA if you have a health-related question. And Kimberly is on line 3. Kimberly.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
My question for you is, I have a hemorrhagic cyst that's 1.5 by 1.5 on my left ovary,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like I may have to wait until November to get a consult to get the surgery to have it removed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, is there a possibility that it could burst or rupture? And if it does, is that at all dangerous?
Well, hemorrhagic cyst, as it implies, is that there's some bleeding inside a cyst. This is mm-hmm. on the ovary?
It is, on the left
yeah.
ovary.
Yeah. And these are very common type of cysts to have. Usually
okay.
when they rupture, they will rupture during the time that you are ovulating. So sort of mid-cycle that this
okay.
will happen. And when they do rupture, the damage that they do is primarily more painful than damaging. The fluid that is inside the cyst, when it's released, can cause a sort of a sudden onset of lower quadrant abdominal pain, depending on the side that the cyst is on, which can last several days up to a week and is usually controlled with pain medications because the fluid is then gradually reabsorbed. So in terms of health dangers, there really isn't any. It doesn't become infected. It can be, though, very, very painful when it bursts. There are
right.
several other ways to try to prevent cysts from growing or even rupturing. And one of them is using the birth control pill over the short term if there's no contraindications, because that suppresses ovulation and reduces the risk of that cyst rupturing during your cycle. And for some women, when they take the birth control pill, it can help actually reduce the size of the cysts over time. So
right.
that is another option as opposed to doing surgery. But again, you know, 1.5 by 1.5 is about a 3 by 3 centimeter, 4 by 4 centimeter cyst. So that's a fairly nice sized cyst that's there. And certainly it does run the risk of rupturing. But as I mentioned, if it does rupture, it's more pain control. It's not going to cause any long-term damage to any internal organs or reproductive organs either.
Okay, perfect. That was my concern. I'm taking something they call metformin,
mm-hmm.
But I had thought perhaps that would, I'm actually spotting with this cyst and have been for the past 6 months. It's causing me to bleed almost on a regular basis, which has triggered another problem of anemia. So I'm taking iron and metformin. I had thought perhaps might shrink it. I don't know, but it doesn't seem to, I don't think it's shrinking it, but it's certainly, I had hoped it would help it from keeping it getting bigger. I don't know, does it, can it do that, or is that not going to help at all?
Well, metformin is usually prescribed for women who have a diagnosis of polycystic ovarian disease.
I do have that. Yeah. I do have that, yeah.
Which does tend to minimize and try to mitigate the cyst growth and also to help reestablish a normal cycle. But with regards to the bleeding is unlikely from the cyst itself because there's no direct connection between the ovary and the ovarian cyst and the fallopian tube and bleeding. You really won't see bleeding that way. The bleeding usually occurs, especially if it's mid-cycle bleeding or irregular bleeding, it's usually from the uterine tissue or the endometrium itself, which is likely due to hormone fluctuations during the month that don't stimulate the tissue enough to keep it from bleeding, because during a period your estrogen and progesterone levels drop, and the tissue that depends on that hormone level to maintain itself now starts to break down and you have a normal period. But if during that month the hormone levels are fluctuating, that tissue, the integrity of the tissue, may not be maintained, and some of it flakes off and you end up with a bit of bleeding. But the cyst itself shouldn't be causing the bleeding. It's likely within the uterine cavity itself that the bleeding is coming from.
So could that be from endometriosis?
Endometriosis will give you bleeding if, and usually happens only during your period, because the tissue itself from endometriosis is essentially endometrium or uterine tissue. And endometriosis is where that tissue appears in other parts of the body, usually in the abdominal cavity, and it's not in the uterus anymore, but it still responds to the same hormone levels. So during the time when you're not having any vaginal bleeding from a period, you shouldn't have any bleeding from the endometrial tissue. It starts to bleed, though, when you do have your period, and that's when you can get abdominal pains, scarring from the bleeding that's occurring, and having the organs being stuck together, because that tissue acts almost like a glue, and when it does bleed, it causes that type of damage in the pelvis. But in and of itself, the endometriosis shouldn't cause bleeding outside of your cycle unless you are having irregular hormone cycles which are affecting the uterus the same way as they're affecting the endometrial tissue or the endometriosis, in which case you would have bleeding in those other areas.
Okay. So it's more than likely being caused by hormones being out of balance.
It usually is a cycle that's not following a normal pattern. It's sort of a disrupted cycle.
Good luck, Kimberly. Let's take another call. Kevin.
Yes, Dr. Dworkin.
Yes, sir.
I've had, if you like, lung problems for quite a while. And coincidentally, I was in to see my regular GP.
Mm-hmm.
He did a full physical and decided that I had a bit of infection in my lungs.
Okay.
Now, this was probably caused by 25 years of one pack a day smoking.
Okay.
My rheumatologist treated me with methotrexate,
mm-hmm.
which I understand is not real good for lungs either. But GP prescribed methotrexate as an antibiotic to try and solve the coughing.
Okay.
Lung infection.
Yeah. It sounds like a quinolone. It's probably mispronounced a bit, but it sounds like a quinolone antibiotic that he gave you.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, at the same time, my rheumatologist is giving me Enliven.
I'm not sure if that's being pronounced. Is it Enbrel? Is that what they're giving you? Or
no, Enliven. It's a needle.
Okay.
In the thigh for arthritis.
Okay.
And she was wondering whether a antibiotic such as that would be wise to take with a immune suppressant such as Enliven.
Well, in this case, if you do have a pneumonia and you have, from what you're describing, it's either, is it rheumatoid arthritis that you have?
Yeah.
So Yeah, I mean, the thing is you have a, what's called a comorbid state, meaning that you have an underlying disease process, and on top of that, you now have a pneumonia, which is what the lung infection that your physician's concerned about. And so the treatment for the pneumonia is using a quinolone antibiotic, and you have to watch kidney function when you take this antibiotic. You do a blood test to check what's called a creatinine level, and you can calculate how well the kidneys are working. But it is the treatment of that is recommended. Again, it's taken short term. It's taken for about 10 days, and you can be monitored while you're using it. But ultimately, the pneumonia has to be treated, and other antibiotics are not going to do the job as well as this particular one, which are called the second generation quinolone antibiotics, because of this comorbid state that you have. So what I would say is that your family doctor is probably correct with regards to the choice of the medication, and it's simply a matter of monitoring. They can do a blood test halfway through that you're being treated to check kidney function to see how that's going. But overall, I would say that it's a relatively safe thing to be doing.
Okay. We'll pick it up after the news and more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA, and I'm Rob Snow. So great to be with you. Number of callers been waiting a long time to talk to you, Dr. Dworkin. Mm-hmm. So right back to the phone lines. Lorraine.
Hello.
Hi, Lorraine.
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Dworkin.
That's good, because I probably can't answer your question.
All right. Just recently, my husband had a stent put into his common bile duct to alleviate jaundice.
Yes.
How long can we expect to wait to see improvement?
Usually once a stent is put in and the stent opens up the duct, so it allows bile to go through, you should see, by measuring blood levels, you usually take what's known as a bilirubin level.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're looking for is the rate of decline in bilirubin levels. So although the jaundice, if he is jaundiced, the jaundice may remain there for quite some time, but it's the blood test that will tell you whether the jaundice will eventually disappear. So it'll give you sort of a prediction of what's going to happen. I don't know if the blood tests have been done or how long ago the stent was put in.
Okay, the blood tests haven't been done. The stent was just put in Monday.
Okay. So what they're going to do is likely do blood tests on an ongoing basis to look and see if the level is going down, and that will actually provide you with your answer. It's very difficult for me to tell you how long it will take, because I don't know how the extent of the disease that he had that caused it and what level that he started off with regards to the level of bilirubin, because if he started off with a very high level, obviously it'll take longer for the jaundice to disappear if it started off very high, as opposed to having jaundice with a lower level. So that's the rate limiting step. So unfortunately, I can't give you a straight answer with the time, because the numbers are what are going to tell you. And the only way to know that is by doing a few blood tests. Usually they may do this one week after another in order to give you the points on the graph to give you a prediction of how long it will take for it to come down to normal.
All right. He has a problem with swollen legs, and he was given a product called furosemide.
Right.
Will this be helpful in reducing the fluid in his legs?
It usually is. Furosemide is a diuretic, so it allows the kidneys to drain water out of your body, so it filters more water out of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can help reduce the swelling in the legs. If the swelling is due to factors related to the kidney or the heart, it usually will do a good job at eliminating some of that water.
And does it take a while before it to take effect?
Again, it depends on how much swelling there is in the legs and how much water or fluid overload there is.
Mm-hmm.
So it can take a bit of time. Furosemide has a six-hour half-life, meaning it lasts 6 hours. That's why it was called Lasix, was the brand name, and it lasts 6 hours, so they call it Lasix. And so if he's taking it once a day, it'll help drain some of the water out, but because it lasts 6 hours, you may get some fluid accumulation afterwards, so the physicians may want to give you a dose twice a day as opposed to once a day. But it's the information being provided is a bit limited, but what I can say is it's the numbers that will mean something as the tests are done.
Okay, let's go to Chris on line one. Chris.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hi,
go ahead.
Not too bad. How are you?
We're good. Thank you, Chris.
I just have a quick question. I had a blood clot about 9 years ago in my right leg. And it seems to be, I wear a compression stocking.
Okay.
And sometimes I get pain on the inside of my leg on the top part.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if this is going to keep depreciating, or if there's anything I can do to
Did they give you a reason why you had the clot in the first place?
Yeah, they diagnosed me with antithrombosis deficiency factor 3 and Leiden factor 5.
Right, so you have a propensity or a chance of developing a clot. Do they have you on blood thinners?
Yes, warfarin.
Okay, so it's unlikely if the warfarin is therapeutic and has always remained in a level to prevent clots, it's unlikely that you're going to get another clot in the leg with the warfarin. So that will keep things at bay. But you're saying, is it the stocking itself that's causing a problem? Is that what you're
saying? I was doing some work this weekend, and mm-hmm. I was working on patio stones at home and on my knees a lot. And the next day, the pain on the inside of my leg was just horrendous.
That's unlikely from any clot that's being formed. It's likely just the fact that of those patio stones and moving things around, you likely pulled something in the leg as opposed to causing a clot in that area. Usually a clot, and I'm sure you're very well aware of it, given that you had one, it causes the leg to swell up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And in this case, in the absence of any swelling, redness, it's unlikely that there's any clot, especially if the Coumadin or warfarin level is therapeutic. This is likely more soft tissue damage that's resulted of the work you were doing as opposed to the underlying clotting defect that you have.
Okay.
It seems to be... I get a lot of varicose veins there.
Right. The varicose veins can be a bit painful, but again, they shouldn't clot up because, again, you're taking a medication that's going to prevent that. Varicose veins, sometimes you can get what's called superficial phlebitis, but again, less likely to happen if you're taking the warfarin. It's really to prevent you from having another major clot in your leg or a deep vein thrombosis. So the varicose veins, if they do swell up and they get puffy, can cause some pain in the leg, but it's not usually because of a clot. It's because the veins are dilating and get a bit swollen. But if you're concerned about the pain that you're having in your leg, and it's always good to look at the veins themselves. So you may want to have that looked at in order to know whether these veins are enlarging, maybe even doing another Doppler of the legs to see the size of the veins. But more than that, unfortunately, I can't give.
Let's go to Yvonne. Yvonne.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. I'm calling about Lipitor.
Mm-hmm.
A little background. I've been on Lipitor for about 5 years, 10 milligrams a day.
Okay.
I was put on there solely because of a high cholesterol level.
Okay.
I'm 63 years old. I have no family history of heart disease, strokes. I have an excellent diet. I exercise. I'm not overweight.
Okay.
My problem is the side effects, the sort of Lipitor leg syndrome.
You're getting pains in the legs?
Yeah, just kind of annoying. It's mm-hmm. all get out. And I just assume quit taking stuff, to be honest with you. And I'm just wondering, in other words, I have none of the factors mm-hmm. other than high cholesterol associated with heart disease.
Well, what I would suggest is that there is a means to calculate your risk of heart disease. And mm-hmm. on the basis of that, it takes into account what your cholesterol level was when it was initially measured.
Yeah,
And then they take blood pressure. There's no family history. They'll look at the HDL levels, the good mm-hmm. cholesterol levels. They'll look at the total cholesterol. As I said, whether you're smoking, your blood pressure, and age. And on the basis of that, they come up with a number. And
okay.
that number will reflect whether you're low risk, medium risk, or high risk. And with that number, you can then very easily determine what your 10-year risk of heart disease is. And if it's a low risk, there's no need to be on Lipitor.
Okay.
So that in order to know what to do, the best thing is I would go to your doctor and say, can you calculate my cardiovascular risk, my 10-year risk of heart disease on the basis of the lab values that you have?
Okay.
And what it was also when I was, 5 years younger, what my cholesterol level was, what my blood pressure was at the mm-hmm. time. Calculate out what that risk is. And if that risk is low, then there's no need to be on that Lipitor.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, so that's the way I would approach that, because that way you'll have an evidence-based answer and you'll know for sure whether you need to be on it or not.
That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye.
Craig is up next on line 3. Craig?
Yes.
Hi, Craig. Go ahead.
Dr. Dworkin.
Yes.
A few weeks ago, you were talking to a guest about dry cracked hands, and there was a product you mentioned at the time. I can't remember what it was, but
I think this came up during the winter months.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Yeah, it was a while back because both Dr. Dworkin and I suffer from winter eczema, yeah, I guess you could. Yeah. And I've started using a product called Eucerin, which you just buy over the counter at any drugstore. Well. And I have to tell you, I'm very impressed with it.
Yeah.
It's a skin cream, but there's I don't know what's
it has,
in it.
It has urea in it. It's an emulsion.
It's and very effective.
There's Eucerin.
How do you spell it?
Eucerin. And there's other ones called Uremol, Uremol. It's just another company that makes pretty much the same thing. And,
okay.
And so those are just emollients. They will moisturize and hydrate the skin. They can be used many times during the day.
Over the counter.
And they're over the counter.
Yeah, it's a little it's on the expensive side, but well worth it.
And another one that's out there that I tend to recommend to patients is called Spectro Eczema Care, which also, similar vein, it moisturizes the skin and tends to work quite well for dry skin, dry, itchy skin.
Excellent.
Okay, Craig.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I shouldn't be giving medical advice.
We'll give you some leeway.
Okay. Okay. Last call of the hour goes to Russ. Hi, Russ.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, I'm recovering a heart patient over the winter. We see complications from H1N1, which weakened my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor there have told me that I should limit my fluid intake to 1,500 milliliters a day of fluid, period. Mm-hmm. But they never tell me why, and I can't get a response on that. So,
what I would ask them, if they're recommending that, is whether they think that your heart has suffered an injury that makes its... There's a term I'm going to give you to ask them, okay?
Okay.
Ask them what your heart's ejection fraction is. Ejection fraction is a measure of percentage of how much blood... How much
at
blood...
At that time, it was 39%, and it's moved up to 42.
Okay, so that's just about the... That's actually within normal range, so that's pretty good. The other is to ask whether there is any, whether they're concerned about any congestive heart failure, because again,
I did get congestive heart failure.
Okay. So that's
fluid buildup around the heart muscle.
Right. So now was it a pericarditis that you had? Is that what they diagnosed it as? It's called cardiomyopathy.
Yeah. Cardiomyopathy.
Yeah. So what they're concerned about is by taking too much fluid, you may overload the heart's capacity to pump efficiently. You overload it. It's like putting too much. You have a pump that's going and you pour too much water in it and the pump just can't keep up.
Right.
The water backflows and you can get swelling and edema in the legs and such. And
sounds
it puts
dangerous.
A lot of,
yeah.
And fluid in the lungs too. So everything backs up. So I think that's why they've recommended low fluid intake.
Got to wrap it up there.
Sure thing.
Are you in on Sunday?
I am in on Sunday.
All right. And then you're off to Boston.
Off to Boston.
For a road trip and all around New England.
All around New England, whale watching.
Very
looking
good.
Forward to it.
Have a great time.
Thank you.
We'll miss you next week.
I will be back.
Okay. Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call. Don't forget the Sunday House Call. Sundays at 4 and Health Headlines with Dr. Dworkin at 10 to 7 during Madeley in the Morning.